way down in the Bible Belt, it's hard to have a time. Mama caught my daddy stepping out to buy some wine. Daddy said, hey, mama, I got to have my fun.
Well, welcome to this week's episode of For What It's Worth. I'm your host, Blake Melnick, and this is our next installment in our series, The Many Faces of Innovation, called Eyes Wide Open. My guest today is Sue Seary, founder and CEO of Iris Booth. Sue, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Blake. I'm really happy to be here.
Let's begin with a little bit about you. I always do this with my guests so our listeners get a sense of who you are. So tell us about Sue Seary.
Absolutely. I was born and raised in Nova Scotia. I am a professional photographer, have been my entire adult life. I got my start in photography becoming the first female press photographer to ever work in Nova Scotia, working for the Halifax Herald, and went on to have a fairly successful career in both commercial, lifestyle, portrait, and studio photography. My most recent gig was as a studio photographer in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Was photography something you wanted to do ever since you were a young child?
I have always been really fascinated by photography. So, Blake, I grew up really, really poor. No one in my family, no one that I knew, had any photographic equipment. So there are such a scarcity of photographs from my childhood. I don't have more than two or three photographs of myself, my family members, my parents. So photographs always seemed kind of magical and otherworldly to me. And at the age of 15, a career counselor at my high school in rural Nova Scotia put a Nikon EM in my hands and crowned me the head of the photography club and gave me the keys to the darkroom, and that was it. I've never done anything else in my life.
So I assume you were developing your own pictures in a darkroom. This seems to be a lost art. I don't know anybody that does that anymore.
It is a replaced art. It has become replaced by the art of Photoshop.
Right.
So we went from doing it in an analog fashion to a digital fashion, but actually the artistic process isn't that different.
Okay, so you've been a photographer since a very young age. You were born and raised in Halifax. Let's talk a little bit about those early days and what it was like for you.
I was one of those lucky people that got up every single day, every day of my life, and did exactly what I wanted to do. What happened, though, was that technology was threatening the industry in a really profound way. Remember, I had lived through auto exposure, autofocus, the age of digital.
Sure.
But cell phone photography was the greatest, most present threat to our industry.
Right.
In that moment. Also, I was approaching an age where photography was becoming more difficult. It's a very physical job. It's very style-based. So I felt my younger peers were sort of nipping at my heels in terms of creativity and fresh approach. So I recognized that I had to have a final chapter, a swan song, so to speak.
Were you doing a lot of school photography, student headshots, and that kind of thing?
Never school photography. I had a very exclusive, beautiful studio in downtown Halifax, and I did very high-end corporate headshots.
Wow.
$300 to $500 a pop. They were coming in all day long. It was the who's who of the Halifax crowd.
Right.
So I was already doing headshots. And remember, I started back in the 90s when only really high-level executives and real estate agents had headshots.
Right, of course.
And then we transitioned to this time where even my plumber has a headshot on LinkedIn. So it was the only genre in photography that was actually still thriving. Everything else was struggling. So I had already intuitively been moving towards more headshot-based studio in Halifax when I got an RFP from a local university to do 4,000 grad photos. And I cringed, but the business sense in me was like, how can I do this?
And then you had this aha moment, an epiphany of sorts.
I had an aha moment around the dinner table. So my two children at the time, both in university, believe it or not, Kim Kardashian had just come out with a book called Selfie. Selfies were just becoming a real thing. And I was joking And I said, I'm going to take all my gear. I'm going to set it up in a vacant classroom at St. Mary's. I'm going to record my voice, you know, like lean in, look at the camera, keep your chin down. And I was going to give the kids a remote and charge them $20 each to come into the room and take their own selfie grad photos. Both my kids put their utensils and said, wow, that's an idea. That'll actually work. That's a really good idea. Kids would love that.
So where did you go from there?
Where I went from there was to try to imagine how I could do this in a really automated, professional-looking way.
Right.
So I went into my living room with cardboard and craft paper, and I crafted the very rudimentary prototype of what I thought this could be. And I took 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper and made a user experience, user flow, and just went about it in a very kind of kindergarten way initially.
Well, I love this. And this is really design thinking. Young children have this innate sense of experimentation and creativity. And if we allow ourselves to go back to that childlike state of play almost in order to create the prototype using whatever you have at hand, bits of paper, objects in your house, furniture, you're able to create a visual or at least an imaginary representation of your idea. And I think that's really cool. So you created this mock-up, and then what?
And then I knew I had to go to the next step, which was to develop a functional prototype.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really nice and somewhat unique about the Halifax environment is we have a lot of public funds that we can access.
Right.
And Halifax was just really focused on innovation and becoming a tech hub. So there was a lot of funding and supports available. So I immediately started looking for those supports. And those supports ended up being, thankfully, not just financial, but also mentorship, resources. I was connected to the engineering department at Dalhousie to help develop this. I was able to hire software engineers to come in. So I really tapped into that sort of public support network that's available in Halifax.
And public funds. So you worked very closely with universities to help develop and refine this initial prototype?
The first pitch was to National Research Council of Canada. And I remember walking into this guy's office, and I had been told probably about an hour before that pitch that this guy's nickname was the Drain Killer.
I've met some of those guys.
I was so nervous. I was just thinking he was going to shoot this idea like all to hell. And I walked in and I gave him a pitch, and it turns out that he was a really avid photographer. Mm. So he kind of understood what I was saying. He understood what I was doing. He loved the idea and ended up becoming a bit of a champion for me.
Right.
So not only did he not kill my dream, he was instrumental in sort of that early development of the prototype.
Sure, because he understood the medium, and that's really important. So you came to the National Research Council, you pitched your idea, and did they give you money?
The Atlantic Canadian Opportunities Agency, mm-hmm, and NSBI, which is the Nova Scotia Business Inc. I was able to access funds, resources, mentorship through them, and also partner with the local university to make that first prototype.
And so tell me about that first prototype. What did it look like? How did you come up with the design idea? Did you have a vision in your head? Was it the result of your collaboration with the universities and their engineering departments? Who came up with that initial design?
The initial design intention to make it as different from that nostalgic photo booth we would see at the mall. Right. I wanted it to be such a departure from that it ended up looking like a Campbell's soup can. It was round. It was a cylinder. No one understood what it was. It was very difficult to manufacture. And it had a lot of structural problems. But I did hear from somebody really early on that if you don't look back at your initial prototype of your product 5 years down the line and just cringe, then you haven't come far enough.
Right.
So I definitely moved on from that early design.
Well, that's a perfect segue to the next part of our conversation, which is Iris Booth itself. So what is Iris Booth?
Iris Booth is a self-serve product that delivers professional headshots and integrated badging solutions.
So Iris Booth is really sort of the next generation of something that we all know and are familiar with, the photo booth. You and I, of course, remember going into these photo booths when we were kids with our friends or by yourself. You put in your money and then you wait patiently while the photos are being produced in the machine and they drop out in front. And you have this wonderful memento. I know for me growing up in Toronto, we had them at the Canadian National Exhibition. We had them in the subway stations and they were always a lot of fun. So that's really what Iris Booth grew from, was it not? It's kind of the next generation of the classic photo booth.
It is. It's a combination of the evolution of the nostalgic photo booth and how fun and fanciful that was, and taking a professional studio headshot, which can be, for some people, very anxiety-inducing.
Sure.
But delivers great results. Mm-hmm. And then I married those two things.
Yeah, brilliant.
So I'm giving you a fun, easy, relaxed environment where you're in control, but I'm still delivering professional quality headshots. So I married the two together.
You know, when we first talked about this idea a couple of years ago, Sue, I really didn't get it. And I said this in my trailer. I understood it, but I didn't see the value proposition. In my head, it was, okay, so this is a new version of the photo booth. Eventually, though, I did start to understand how this could be of value. But I have a couple of questions. Number one, what do you think has changed in the world to make the product you've developed, number one, grow so quickly, and number two, have such mass appeal?
The easy answer to that is LinkedIn. LinkedIn is sort of the pinnacle of online presentation for professionals. And how we think about and how we define professional has really expanded over the years. Right. Professionals used to be C-level executives. Now you can be a professional in pretty much any industry. Mm-hmm. And it has become very imperative that we have a personal brand, because no longer do we enter the job market anticipating to retire from our first position.
Sure.
So we continually have to promote ourselves online, and that has driven this demand for personal branding, and we're a really key piece of that.
Iris Booth looks very much like an Apple product. In fact, I could imagine Apple designing something that would look almost identical to what you've done here. So what informed your current design of the booth?
So there were a few major considerations. The biggest one, like I mentioned earlier, was not to have it too reminiscent of that sort of dusty...
that curtain that you draw across.
That dusty curtain. I wanted it to feel very fresh, very modern. Mm-hmm. It is a digital product. I wanted it to feel very open and inviting with no physical barriers to get in.
Right.
While still maintaining a small footprint. So those were my physical challenges, right. Was how do we make it feel as big as possible while maintaining the smallest possible footprint?
And how big is it?
It takes up a footprint of 20 square feet, so 4x5. So it's not quite that large, but it needs 20 square feet to live and operate.
Okay, so you've got this slick prototype design. Who was your first customer?
Our first corporate customer was Indeed, the online hiring platform.
Right, right.
And I got a call from a gentleman in Dublin who, according to his colleagues, is difficult to understand. So for me in Canada, listening to his accent, and he spoke very quickly, and I'll be honest, I thought it was a prank call. I did not believe this was happening, but he wanted a booth for their corporate office in Austin, Texas. Mm. And they were our first corporate client. We had a booth stand with a retail model where we corporately deployed booths, offered them to the public, and charged an individual fee. But Indeed was our first corporate client.
And what was the value they saw in Iris Booth for their company?
So the fellow from Dublin was in their physical security department. He was looking for a badging solution. He wasn't even looking for headshots, and we weren't even thinking about badging. at that particular time, but he wanted to automate badging. So that's what he was looking for.
And this was all for internal purposes, for Indeed staff.
That's correct.
You mentioned you began with a retail model, but then you changed directions. Tell me why.
The retail model was a really quick way to bankrupt the company. And I was fortunate enough to figure it out just in time.
Right.
So with the retail model, we had a brand new product that the population didn't understand. You yourself said, I didn't quite understand it initially.
Right.
So you put basically what looks like a fancy photo booth in a shopping mall and trying to charge people $20 and get them to understand it's not for fun, it's for professional headshots.
Right.
Take an enormous amount of marketing. It also meant that we had to manufacture and deploy and maintain all of these units in the market.
Of course, yeah.
And it was going to take millions and millions of dollars to even start to make a dent. So right. There was just no way to capture a market big enough to get momentum, to earn that money back $20 at a time. Mm. It was just a failed idea. The product idea was there, but the business model was not really flawed.
So talk to me about how you changed your business model.
David Boschel gave me a phone call one day from Ireland and said, we need a unit at our corporate office in Austin, Texas. And I said, here's the way we do this. This is our path forward. I recognized it instantly because it was an immediate sale. Our business model is that we sell the hardware, much like you would buy a cell phone. But the hardware doesn't really do anything unless you buy a service agreement from us, which is a recurring annual service fee.
Right.
So it's a really nice business model. It's very stable for us. And it turns out that lots of corporations, Indeed now has about 12 of these in three countries. Mm. We have a lot of clients that have multiple units. And we sell the product, we build to order, we don't need to maintain massive amounts of inventory. And then we also have this nice business model with recurring revenue.
Right. So my understanding is an organization buys the hardware, which is the booth itself, but then they're paying a recurring fee for use of the software, which makes the booth work. I want to talk a little bit about the software because when you first mentioned Iris Booth to me, I thought, oh boy, there are going to be some real issues around disclosure of personal information or risk of disclosure of personal information and that kind of thing. So tell us how the software works with the hardware and how you manage to navigate around this potential liability.
The software that we utilize on the back end is all proprietary. It's something we've developed in-house. And what I basically tried to do was to be mindful of all the pain points that I would have experienced doing multiple headshots for corporations in my shooting years, and then try to resolve those using the software that we built. So one of the issues that was always a big concern is that I would go into a law office and do 50 headshots. 48 people would show up, they'd need to be reshoot. So right away the booth excels because it's there, it's 24/7, sure. Come eight as you want. Another one was how you disseminate those photographs. So the individuals would want to see the photos and approve them first, but the client would say, no, 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 send them to us. So we have this great mechanism where the client, the end user, the subject of the photograph, gets to approve their image before anybody else sees it, before it gets saved. It then gets directly sent to an admin account that the corporate client can access. So the software really solves a lot of logistical problems and automates a lot of things that used to be done manually. It does open us up to some data liability issues.
Hmm.
To that end, we are very, very careful not to collect any personally identifiable information, but for an email address for the sole purpose of delivering the product.
Right.
So we have such low level, low value data that we would not be a high target priority for hackers. Having said that, we follow all of the industry standard data protection rules. We have third parties inspect our software, our systems, our platform annually to make sure that there's no holes. We take data protection very, very seriously.
Sure.
It keeps me up at night.
But my understanding is you're not holding any corporate data. Is that correct?
Absolutely not. So yeah. We are not integrated into any external or internal networks in these corporations. What we do is we provide a custom API allows them to reach into our servers and
pull their own data. That makes a lot of sense because when we first talked about Iris Booth, I thought, oh my God, this would be a legal nightmare. And I gather you did go through some hard clients in terms of testing your data integrity. Who was your hardest client to sell on this in terms of protecting personal information?
There's been a lot of hard clients in terms of data protection. And I respect them all for being so very careful.
Sure, they have.
I mean, some of our clients include names like Microsoft and Indeed and LinkedIn, and where data security is vitally important.
Right.
But I would say the two that have been challenging, we have a very healthy school program, and those are often publicly funded. So they have very stringent rules around data protection, but healthcare. We do big healthcare in the US, and that's where we see a lot of second guessing and a lot of concern around how we handle data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense to me. But you touched on something else I'm interested in exploring with you, your market.
Yes.
Is it largely in the U.S.?
It is. Probably 85% of our revenue comes from the U.S. Mm. 10% comes from overseas, and maybe 5% here domestically.
So let me make sure I understand this. You're a Canadian innovator. You received public monies in Canada to help develop your innovation into a very successful product, and yet you have almost no market here in Canada. That's a bit surprising.
No, it isn't. Because we are a very innovative population, but we are incredibly risk averse and we are late adopters of technology.
This is a concern I have about Canada's overall capability and willingness to support innovation. Your story is not uncommon. And innovation is developed here in Canada, but the business and the actual product, the end result, is exported to the United States. We don't do a really good job at supporting our own entrepreneurs. Our government funding is such that we use an indirect funding model, whereas other countries, for example, Israel, use a direct funding model. They support an entrepreneur who is developing a new product or a new service by being the first customer. It's a guaranteed sale. And what it does for the entrepreneur is it makes them want to continue to develop and advance their innovation in Canada. But because we don't do that, and our market is much smaller than the US and elsewhere, entrepreneurs get to the point of development, but then have no support afterwards. And therefore, they go to where the bigger markets are. Without that ongoing support mechanism, it's very difficult for Canadian entrepreneurs and inventors and innovators to get the support they need to keep the IP within Canada.
It is. And Canadian companies are also, like I said, a bit gun-shy on new innovations. So they like to see it succeed somewhere else. And now we're starting to get more traction in Canada now that they're seeing success in other markets in the U.S.
Sue's story illustrates some of the shortcomings we have around how we fund and support innovation in Canada. And while I agree with Sue that Canadians tend to have a low risk tolerance for the new, Iris Booth is not a new invention. It's an innovation on something that we're all too familiar with. And it's not hard to get one's head around the myriad of potential applications for this product here in Canada. Clearly, Sue's experience with funding agencies like the National Research Council illustrate that we had folks out there who recognized the potential of this product early on, to the point that they funded Sue through her early development stages. And yet, there was little support for bringing the final product, Iris Booth, into the Canadian marketplace. We have the same needs as Sue's clients did in the United States. Sue was talking about the healthcare system. We need photographs for all our health cards, and for our passports, and for our driver's licenses. These are logical first applications and first customers for Iris Booth. If we had a mechanism in place to support innovation in Canada, whereby the government agreed to be the initial customer, In that way, they could have supported both Sue and the development life cycle and marketing of Iris Booth here in Canada, while satisfying the needs of the Canadian taxpayer by providing a more cost-efficient way for Canadian organizations to produce high-quality, consistent photographs for all our needs. I've worked in aerospace, nuclear energy, oil and gas, and each of these sectors required digital badging. In fact, it's such a critical element of these businesses that a good many companies which operate in these sectors employ people full-time to take employee photographs.
Hi, everybody. This is Tom Locke from Moments in Time, and you're listening to For What It's Worth with your host, Blake Melnick.
Thanks for following our podcast. If you like what we're doing, please consider helping us to continue to produce great content for listeners everywhere by making a small monthly donation using the Support the Show link in the show notes of every episode. For what it's worth. Sue, for our listeners' sake, I'd like you to walk us through the process of how someone would engage with Iris Booth within a corporate setting. So assume I'm a new employee. It's my first day of work. I go to corporate HQ and they say I need a badge and I need to have my photograph taken. Walk us through the process of using Iris Booth.
So the first thing the employee would receive is either an ID number or an email address. They would then stop by an Iris Booth, enter their email address, take a photo, approve the photo. So they can take as many as they want until they get the shot they need. That photo immediately gets sent to the badging office. By the time they finish their session and step outside the booth, they have the photo by email on their phone instantly. It's uploaded to our servers, and then it's made available to the badging station. Oftentimes, by the time they hit the end of the hall, their physical badge with the photo is waiting for them.
Perfect.
Yeah, it's easy. It's great.
And I'm assuming that all the personal data then goes to the corporate database, wherever it is, interfacing through SAP or Oracle or whatever the company is using as a back end, so that the HR department has all that information at the same time?
We can automate everywhere this needs to be disseminated, to the badging station, to the interweb, wherever it needs to be. We can resize, rename, and deliver photos instantly.
Amazingly efficient.
Yes.
So let's talk about the cost. Let's begin with the hardware. How much is it to buy an Iris Booth?
Anywhere from $15,000 to $39,000 to buy the hardware, US dollars.
And what accounts for the variance in pricing?
We have two products. Oh. We have a full-size booth, which is a stunning piece of furniture.
It's a real showstopper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a fully enclosed unit. And it just costs more to build. And then we also have, which outsells the booth now just because it makes so much more sense in many applications, something called an Iris Air, which is a portable unit. And what we've done is we've taken all the electronics and made it a digital standing wall. So it's easier to ship. It's easier to move. It's still quite easy to set up. It delivers essentially the exact same product. It's the same user interface, same electronics, same supportive software in the background.
Right.
And it's significantly less expensive. And we also have special pricing for a school program that we are having great success with.
And then the software side. What's the annual fee for the software?
$6,000 US annually per booth, not per client, per unit.
Right. Okay. That's not a little bit of money, but when you think about what corporations have been paying for this service, you're delivering a lot of value at a really good price point.
You just mentioned that you were at, was it Husky, mm-hmm. you had a full-time photographer mm-hmm. whose sole job was to do this.
Yeah.
I'm fairly certain he made more than $6,000.
I'm sure he did.
So we are a money saver. We try to really lead with, this is economically efficient to do this. It's not a cost center. It's not you're paying for this. You're saving by using Iris Booth.
Right. I know that Iris Booth has been gaining a lot of traction within universities in the United States. I'm assuming this is because of the need for student identification?
It's not. We're actually getting massive traction in career centers. So the career centers have a mandate to level the playing field for all students, those that can and cannot afford to build that personal brand that we talked about earlier. A lot of the historically Black colleges and universities in the U.S., what they have in their career centers are clothing closets that are funded by the likes of JCPenney, where they can go and get suits and business attire and things like that. They can go and get free headshots. So it's a career development tool.
Fascinating.
Yeah. I love being part of this. I love the idea of providing opportunity to people who might not be able to access it otherwise.
And you're also rolling out Iris Booth to sports associations as well, I understand.
Yes, we just landed at the PGA and we've recently done an engagement with the NFL. So there's just so many places that this seems to fit.
I know that's a bit of a loaded question because, as you know, my stepfather, Paul Bogan, was the COO of the PGA of America. I know that if he had seen Iris Booth when he was alive, he would have adopted it immediately. Because an organization like the PGA of America uses badging for almost everything. For their internal personnel, at every major golf event, there is a different set of badges that reflect the event itself, whether it be the PGA Cup or the PGA Championships or the Ryder Cup. And of course, all the entourage, their families and so forth, would all have badging as well. So I had them when I would go to events with Paul. And of course, golf professionals are all listed under the PGA of America. So they would all have photographs associated with their membership. And those photographs would also be posted at their local golf club. So natural fit for the PGA of America. I digress. So when an individual goes into the booth, they have a lot of control over that photo-taking process, do they not? The editing of their own photographs, etc.?
Absolutely, absolutely. So they get to take photos. We give them guidance. There are posing tips and guidance all the way through the user interface. It's very simple to use. They get to review the photos. They can retake photos just like you would at a photo studio. Once they nail it down to three images, they can edit right there in the booth. It's a life-size monitor.
Right.
Yeah, they can do things like whiten their teeth and remove blemishes and add filters and save it. They get access to that photo immediately. They also get access to the other photos they've taken and they can edit online as well.
So they get to use those photographs for their own social media presence, and I'm assuming that's what happens. So it must be of real appeal to the individual. Do you deploy Iris Booth at a lot of trade shows? And if so, do you bring the big booth or the small booth?
We only ever bring the small booth. We always bring the Air. It was developed specifically for events. And we like to say that our events division is, in fact, our marketing division.
Sure.
With a net negative cost.
Right, right, right.
Well, I've attended many conferences in my lifetime, and I've had booths at conferences. I used to think of them as kind of a waste of time because I couldn't get enough of my potential customers' time. How does it work for Iris Booth at conferences?
So a client would hire us to be a part of their activation. And you're right, it's incredibly difficult to stand out at these events. And headshots, everybody is always looking for a new fresh headshot. So it attracts immediately a lot of attention. We set up any number of units within their activation. It not only draws people in, but it gets them to stay there.
Right.
We did an event in Dallas for LinkedIn a couple of years ago. We had 8 units lined up in a row. People were waiting in line for up to an hour.
Is that right?
With 8 units going full tilt.
Wow.
And it was such a lopsided room. Everybody kept coming over and saying, "What is happening here?" So some of our verbiage around our event division is you can hand out a pen and get a 10-second touch point, or you can have your clients come in for an hour. And what that did is it gave the staff within that activation time to go through the line and talk to people and get to know them. And it's just a very different interaction when you're providing this service. But what's really nice about that, too, is something like 98% of the people who use Iris Booth download that image and then reuse it in social media.
Sure. Well, why wouldn't it?
Exactly. Mm. So then what happens is you get a photo from LinkedIn at an event in Dallas. You upload it to social media. And people start asking you, "Where'd you get that headshot done?" So then it becomes a conversation and you remember that.
Right.
As opposed to leaving all that swag in the hotel room before you go back home.
Well, I can see that immediate appeal. When people can use something right away, it's always a good thing. So I'd like to shift our discussion a bit. As you know, this series is all about innovation. So I want to talk to you a little bit about your innovation journey. So what was the time frame from ideation to designing the prototype to going into full production and then your first sale?
From ideation, from the first time I had that dinner table conversation to a working functional prototype was 9 months.
9 months.
I was a bulldog with this. I just thought, you know what? If I'm going to try this, I need to fail fast.
Right.
So 9 months from the time we had the public using it.
And that was to develop the booth itself?
Develop the booth, and we put it in a public space in Halifax, and we were charging people $20 to use it.
That's blindingly quick.
It was ridiculous.
So let me recap a little bit. You took 9 months to go from prototype to market. You began with a retail market, and then you shifted over to a different model. I'm interested to know what pitch you gave your customers to articulate the value proposition of Iris Booth. Because, of course, many companies have people coming at them with grand ideas, new products and services. I know I probably get 100 emails a day from software companies trying to sell me something. What was your elevator pitch and how did you grab their attention?
Well, first of all, I want to clarify that we were in that retail space for 2 full years. We were located at universities in the U.S.,
right.
Very high visibility, and our tagline was headshots for the modern professional. Mm. So those initial photo booths captured a lot of imaginations.
Right.
And I like to say that it doesn't matter what you're selling. If it's a good product, I will find you. You don't need to be on Queen Street in Toronto. You don't need to be on Spring Garden Road in Halifax.
Right.
You just need a good product and the client will find you. And that's what I found every single step of the way. We've not spent a dime, not one nickel on marketing or advertising ever. Clients find us and then we go, right, this is our next market. So in that sense, it's been, I think, a little bit of a unique experience for us.
Right.
And all of my time, just because I love the process of product design and product innovation, has been just making the product so good that people will find us.
Fascinating. And again, your first customer was Indeed, and we talked about why they needed Iris Booth. And I gather they've increased their install base from their initial purchase.
Yeah, I think they have about a dozen units now.
So following the initial sale to Indeed, what, if any, changes did you make to Iris Booth based on feedback from your customers?
Well, the first big one was to shift away from strictly professional headshots to develop this whole badging software. And we did do that. We developed a whole badging software. What we've been able to do is stay very focused on the product, the outcome, which is a singular professional quality headshot.
Right.
And what we've been able to adapt to market needs and market inquiries is how we deliver that product. But we don't change the product. The product is a single headshot.
Right.
So we were asked by JFK Airport to build basically a double wide to do family photos. And I considered it. And we've been asked to do all kinds of crazy things, but we don't. We do one thing. We do one thing only, and that's deliver professional headshots.
I think that's a really great point. Maintaining a singularity of focus, because a lot of companies will start out with a great product. They'll get initial traction and then it goes off the rails. They're afraid to say no when they get a customer saying, I'd like to have this feature. So what happens is the product ends up becoming feature driven rather than function driven. And this happens a lot with software developers. They start out with a good product that's very intuitive, easy to use, and then they solicit feedback from their customers. And the customers request all kinds of changes and new features, and they're afraid to say no. And that's a natural inclination because, of course, you want to appease your customer. But then they keep adding bells and whistles and new features to their product to the point where the user interface makes no sense anymore. The rationale for the product itself becomes muddied. And anybody stepping in and using the product at a later stage of development feels absolutely lost. It can be a really horrible experience.
Right. We've been asked a million times to add video to the booth and to add all kinds of different types of animation and things like that. And we are more focused on building out the back end because that's where the value is for the client and delivering that very elegant solution to the end user, which is a great headshot.
Well, therein lies the strength of your business model. It's elegant and simple, and that's really important. So what new markets have emerged for Iris Booth that have come as a bit of a surprise to you?
I think the school program has really been our sleeper hit. We have made massive inroads into the U.S. Post-secondary education system. Right. All the Ivy League schools, all the big schools, all the little schools, almost every state. I love seeing how popular and how successful that market is. Mm-hmm. We've made real inroads with healthcare.
Right.
I mean, our initial clients were all big tech because they're early adopters.
Sure,
so they saw the value. But the ones that have been pleasant surprises have been universities, healthcare, those institutional organizations. I didn't initially see them as being such a big revenue generator for us.
Were there any other markets that came as a surprise?
So many. You know what? I'll be honest. Every sale and every successful activation feels like a miracle to me. Every time somebody plugs in a booth and it sparks up, I can't explain it. It's like a miracle.
It's exciting. Yeah.
And so as you scaled the business, what was the biggest challenge you faced?
Scaling the business, I would say money.
Yes, most people would say money.
Yeah, money. As a middle-aged woman, I think I heard a stat recently at an event in San Francisco that female founders get one of every $10,000 that male founders get, and that older founders get less money than younger.
Sure.
Which is counterintuitive because the older the founder is, the more likely they are to succeed.
Yes.
Because we don't have time to fail.
Right.
So we just make things succeed. Yeah, definitely access to capital has been challenging, and access to good staffing comes out of that problem because you can't offer really competitive salaries to top talent. First few years, we were really doing things with a lot of students and new grads and just making mistakes that could have been avoided had we been better funded.
This is an important point that Sue has raised, and it shines a spotlight on some of the issues that we have with respect to how we support and fund startups, entrepreneurs, and innovators within Canada. The vast majority of funding available can only be used for capital assets or research, in other words, engaging a university partner, which is a bit ironic because innovators, entrepreneurs are risk takers. In order to be successful, they have to be willing to take risks, and yet our funding agencies in our government are risk adverse. And while there's a lot of funding available in Canada for innovation, it's for things that can easily be quantified and audited, computers, hardware, or it's for giving money to universities, which they already have a mandate to fund. Until funding agencies and government start behaving like the entrepreneurs they want to support and aligning their funding dollars to the specific needs identified by the entrepreneurs and innovators, we're going to continue to have very little impact in terms of GDP from our funding dollars. As Sue mentioned, startups need the best and brightest people to help them grow their business. And they can't attract those people unless there's funding that's earmarked for staffing so that they can offer competitive salaries and attract the right people. Sue, when you talk about the need for talent, what talent are you using with respect to Iris Booth? Are you strictly looking for people to assume a sales role, or is there more to it than that?
Definitely more to it than that. We have an in-house IT team that develop, maintain, and provide customer service to all the software-related products.
Right.
We have a manufacturing team. We have an events division. We have a sales team.
So how many people in total?
I think we're up to 8 or 9 now.
Yeah.
So understandably, money is a challenge. What about production? I assume you're having these booths made by an outside manufacturer. Do you run into problems related to on-time delivery of these booths to meet your customer demand?
We're contract manufacturing, and we're on our third or fourth manufacturer over the course of 8 years. And I wow. think we've landed on the right one now. But we always have capacity issues and we're growing so fast. We've doubled year over year for the last 3 years. So that can become challenging. At one point coming out of COVID, we had a wait list of 16 weeks to get product.
Wow.
That's unacceptable.
Yeah.
We've definitely shortened that. We're working to get on top of it. But manufacturing and shipping are always challenging.
Was that part of the reason why you went to your air booth model? Because it was easier and cheaper to manufacture and ship?
It is definitely faster, which means we can pump out more product. And it's not just the profit margin on the hardware. Really where our profit margin lies is that recurring revenue in the software agreement.
Sure.
Do you ever see eliminating the hardware altogether from your business model?
During COVID, when we had such a mass exodus from office space and a lot of companies were shedding tens of thousands
right.
of square feet of office space, we developed, during those dark days of COVID, we developed a remote badging app to address that situation mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. now people are working from everywhere. That remote badging app is our first step towards a not hardware-based product.
Well, this makes sense to me because, as you say, people are working from everywhere. So in order to meet the needs of your customer, you've got to take your product to where they are. So you've had a long and successful journey with the development of Iris Booth. I'd like you to tell me a little bit about your biggest success stories. What achievements are you most proud of to date?
I think there are two that stand out in my mind. One, when the first time I realized I had made it, we were installing a unit at the LinkedIn offices in the Empire State Building. And I'm walking down a street in New York from my hotel to the Empire State Building, realizing, oh my goodness, I'm going to install my invention in the Empire State Building. If this business collapses tomorrow, I can still look back and catch this moment.
Mm-hmm.
But about a week before we were set to install this unit, and remember, we had no air at this time. It was just the booth. I got a frantic call from the client saying, it's not going to fit in the elevator. So it's too big. And I was devastated. And I was trying to find out if we could crane it up the side using a crane. To find the building. I was like, at this point, the money doesn't even matter. I just need to have this thing in. I think just a few days prior to this being shipped out, my manufacturer at the time literally took a chainsaw, cut it in half, down the middle. We flat packed it. We shipped it to New York and reassembled it on site.
Wow.
It was the craziest thing up to that point that I had ever done. And what came of that is that we now have a very slick system where full-size units are like IKEA furniture. They're
right.
shipped flat
modular.
Out,
yep.
and you just put them together on site if necessary. The second one, I would say, also from the same client, with maybe 4 or 5 months' notice, wanted to take us to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, which mm-hmm. I really wanted to do, a big ticket event. And we didn't have enough time to ship a full-size booth by sea, and it was too big to get in air freight.
Right.
So that event is what sparked us to build the air. Uh-oh. So we prototyped, designed, built the air in 3 months.
Wow.
And shipped it to Davos, shipped the working prototype.
Yeah.
We weren't even sure it was going to hold up. Shipped it across the world. I went to Davos and the thing worked. Again, I always think it's a miracle every time. And that just feels like a pinnacle moment for me.
Sure.
Being there, seeing everybody interact with it. These are economic and political giants. Using my product, it was mind-blowing.
Well, I've been inside the World Economic Forum building, so I know just how perfectly that would have fit within that structure. That's a fascinating story and a great example of rapid prototyping. When we talk about innovation, a lot of people say that true innovators can't be afraid to fail. They have to be willing to take risks. And oftentimes, something might go wrong. But if you don't take the risk, you never advance the product, the idea, or the innovation.
I 100% agree with that.
What's the biggest lesson you've learned throughout your whole innovation journey? Could be about yourself. It could be about the world at large. It could be about people. It could be about the whole process of innovation. What's the most important lesson you've learned from this experience?
Oh my gosh. I've learned so many big, big lessons that my former self from 9 years ago is unrecognizable to me. I would say that innovation is a mindset, not a process. It's not a singular event. Innovation is being able to see how something's always been done and then recognizing that there might be a better way to do it. That's what I've learned about innovation. I always thought innovation was like a bolt of lightning.
Right.
Oh my goodness, here's a new idea.
The proverbial light bulb, yeah.
And I always thought the idea was the product, and it's not, because everybody has great ideas.
Right.
The value is in being able to execute them and having that kind of grit and determination that I didn't know that I had to make it through the most heartbreaking, devastating events, because it will be excruciatingly difficult to swim upstream. I remember shortly after I launched the product, I was receiving such negative comments from my colleagues. Photographers were furious. We got a big write-up in Pixel Magazine and Digital Trends, two big online publications. And they did this like, hey, everybody watch out for this. This is coming for your jobs. And boy, I was not prepared for the fallout from that. My husband would say my biggest lesson is not to take things so personally, because I am very thin-skinned. So I have to kind of insulate myself from some of that.
Well, you've touched on a couple of really interesting things there. Number one, the need to develop a mindset for innovation. And part of that mindset is the need to be very resilient, to stick to your beliefs, to stick to your vision, because of course there will always be people that will try to knock you down and come up with some reason why your idea won't work. And this is largely self-serving. In your example with the two magazine articles, it's almost a knee-jerk reaction where people see something new and think, oh my God, this is somehow going to negatively impact my world. It's going to impact what I do for a living. And in your example, take away jobs. Now, that's a tough hurdle to get over. But you stuck to your guns, and aren't you glad you did? Now, I know this is a tough question, but what's the one piece of advice that you would give innovators, entrepreneurs, or anyone that has a great idea they'd like to bring to life? What's the one piece of sage advice that you would give them?
This predates my Iris Booth experience. This has always been my mantra, that perfection is the enemy of done. You can't wait for something to be perfect, because you don't have enough time and you don't have enough money, and the world will not wait for you to get it perfect. You must launch everything when it's functional and fix it along the way.
Along the way.
Well, this is certainly the approach that the software industry has taken for a number of years, releasing their products in beta form, because they need the feedback from the user and they need to see their product in action in order to identify where the issues are and where they need to go for future development. I worked in the engineering industry for a number of years, and there were two prevailing mindsets. The first one was called the waterfall, which was all about predicting what was going to happen throughout the entire engineering process to deliver a very specific and known end result. Then there was the agile approach, where the engineers built what I will call off-ramps in case there were opportunities to take product development in different directions. And that allowed them to pivot very quickly if an opportunity arose that they hadn't anticipated at the outset. It seems to me that you really advocate for more of an agile approach. So it doesn't have to be perfect. You have to get it out and you can make improvements along the way. So knowing what you know now, if you did it all over again, would you do anything differently?
No. I had some monumental setbacks, both professionally and personally, through the process of developing both the product and the company. But I wouldn't honestly do anything different, because to short-step any of those obstacles would have been a shortcoming in the end. So I would do it all the same. Maybe just try not to take everything so, quite so personally, but I would do it the same.
This has been a really fantastic discussion, Sue. So how can people see your product? Where can somebody go to see an Iris booth or experience it in action?
So this is a very self-serving answer. I think absolutely everyone should go to their employer, to their school, to their organization, to their corporation, and lobby to get an Iris booth in their office. Yeah. Because this is such a great product, both for the individual end user in terms of personal branding, but also for the organization in terms of just efficiency. It's a way to provide professional development in a really easy, fun mm-hmm. environment. There are no public-facing booths, so you can't just go out and find one. You have to have one available to you. But I can't think of many instances where an Iris booth wouldn't be a value add when you have, I would say, over 100 employees in a single campus.
Are there any up-and-coming conferences that people might be able to attend and see the Iris booth in action?
Absolutely. Well, so we haven't really talked that much about the event division, but we do some really big events. We've done Ad Week in New York. We've done WEF. We've done the NFL. We do South by Southwest. We're at a lot of events. Our fall lineup is pretty full. So if you're at a conference or event, there's a very good chance you'll run into an Iris booth. And if you do, take it for a test drive.
Perfect. And of course, for our listeners, we will put up some photographs and some contact information for Sue. And Sue, anything else that you would like us to include on our show blog about Iris booth, please feel free to submit that. People will be able to go and find out more about your wonderful product. Sue, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I think it's added a lot of clarity to the whole idea of the innovation mindset, that there are elements of tenacity, resilience, and reflection that have gone into the development of Iris Booth. And the show really is about trying to get people to understand that innovation isn't solely the preserve of well-funded universities or venture capitalists or huge corporations, that people can access and become innovators themselves in the context of what excites them and what motivates them, and that we need to develop the skills associated with that innovation mindset. I think you provided some great examples and some great stories, and I really appreciate you stopping by for the interview today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Blake.
Following our interview, Sue reminded me that I neglected to ask her how she came up with the name Iris Booth. And it really is all in the name. Iris is Siri spelled backwards. For what it's worth. This concludes this week's episode of For What It's Worth, called Eyes Wide Open, with my guest, Sue Siri, founder and CEO of Iris Booth. Join us next week for an episode of The Space in Between, where I'll be joined by my co-host Cameron Brown to talk about what we're listening to, what we're watching, and what we're reading, to give you something to do through to the end of the summer and into those early fall months. I'm sad to announce that Hugh Siegel, a past guest on For What It's Worth, passed away on August 10th, 2023. My sincere condolences to Hugh's family during this difficult time. Hugh was a remarkable man, great Canadian. He served our country as Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Brian Mulroney and later as a senator. Hugh was also the champion for basic income for Canadians and wrote a terrific book called Boots Need Bootstraps, which he kindly gave me following our interview. I will post a link to our interviews with Hugh in the show notes for this week's episode. If you haven't had a chance to listen to this interview, please do. It's very enlightening, very worthwhile. Hugh, you will be missed. I'll miss your energy and your passion for Canada and Canadians. Thanks for following our podcast For What It's Worth with Blake Melnick, and please consider helping us to continue to grow the show by posting a review on your favorite podcast listening channel. Thanks again for listening. For What It's Worth.